Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives, so please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
The feature-length documentary Culture Warrior, Don Wildman and the Battle for Decency, premiering November 11th, chronicles the life and ministry of Don Wildman. It takes you through the founding of the National Federation for Decency, what has become AFA. It's a call to stand firm for righteousness and shows how that resolve can make a huge difference in our world.
If we lose this cultural war, we're going to have a hedonistic, humanistic society.
Find out more and watch the trailer at culturewarrior.movie.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. It is Tuesday, April 1st, and Florida's special elections could determine the balance of power in D.C. So voters around Central Florida are heading to the polls in several special elections throughout the state Tuesday. And so if you are in those Florida special districts, you need to get out and vote today. Also, Governor Ron DeSantis had an announcement yesterday that property tax relief, not sales tax cuts, is Florida's priority. He said, "I don't want to give tourists a tax cut," and so is proposing a $1,000 tax break for homestead property owners instead of the $5 billion sales tax cut proposed by House Speaker Daniel Perez. So Governor Ron DeSantis joins me now. Good morning, Governor. Such a privilege to have you back on the show. We always appreciate hearing from you. And as a Floridian and a homeowner, I fully agree with your position. Why is this so controversial?
Well, I don't think it is controversial. I think that the people overwhelmingly agree that if you look at what Floridians are facing, we've had a lot of people that have moved here, want to live here. Home values have skyrocketed, and there's benefits to that because if you own a home that you bought 20 years ago, it's now worth a lot more. But the flip side of that are these local governments will assess your property at higher and higher levels. So you could have bought a house 20 years ago for $250,000. In some parts of Florida, they're now telling you it's worth $1 million. And even with homestead protection, your property taxes go up, even if they're not raising the millage rate. And so that's been something. And then if you have to move, if you live in Orlando and you get transferred, you got to work in Jacksonville, you buy a house there, you're going to buy a house at a higher value most likely, and the basis for tax is going to be higher. So then you're locked into even higher levels of property taxes. And so this is something that we want to remedy. Now, the larger philosophical question will be something that will be on the ballot in 2026, because this is a constitutional issue for local governments, or they're the ones that apply most of this. But philosophically, do you ever really own your property and your home if you have to continue to pay tax to the government just for the privilege of simply using what is supposed to be yours? It's almost like you're paying rent to the government. And we have folks who've owned homes for 30, 40 years, and they're still having to write checks. That cuts against our idea of private property ownership. It's supposed to be something that's outside the reach of the government. It's one thing to tax somebody on a sale, but to keep taxing them on it really is not a good form of taxation at all. Now, we're in a situation in Florida. We have the luxury, because we had 142 million visitors last year, we can offload the tax burden. We do it to a certain extent at the state, but the local governments, they can unload that to tourists and foreigners and part-time residents. And our Florida full-time residents or Florida residents will be able to reap the benefits of that. So that's going to go on the ballot in 2026. We're working on getting through that. I think it's going to be a really great thing for Floridians to have an opportunity to do. But until then, when the House of Representatives said they wanted to do $5 billion in tax relief. And just put that in perspective, I've done more tax relief than any governor in the history of the state by a country mile, but we've never done in 1 year $5 billion. The most we did was $2.5 billion. We usually do $1 billion, $1.5 billion, which is good. It's meaningful. But if we are going to be able to do $5 billion, if that can work in the budget, then you got to go on the property tax. That's where people are feeling it. I mean, you have some people, you know, that pay a few thousand dollars, but you got a lot of people that pay $10,000-$15,000, and these are middle class people every year on property tax. And so this is really meant to be a bridge to give people some relief until we can have the vote in November of 2026. And again, the reason why we have to do that, property taxes are constitutional. They are vested overwhelmingly in local government. So if they're doing assessments on you in your county in Florida, that's not the state of Florida doing that. That is your local county or municipality.
And that all just makes so much sense that people who own their own homes outright shouldn't continue to pay basically rent to the government. And so how did this get passed in the first place? Because it seems like so many of the tax obligations that people genuinely don't like, as you mentioned, it is constitutional, but that had to start somewhere. And so how did this even begin that we, the citizens, gave over that ability to the government to tax us?
I mean, this goes back to colonial America and in Europe even before that. And in fact, when the founders articulated the rationale for the Constitution of the United States, one of the things that they mentioned in the Federalist Papers was there's no authority of the federal government to apply what were considered direct taxes. A direct tax had to be equal among the states. So functionally, you just couldn't do it. So they said the federal government's going to do indirect taxes. And at that time, it was consumption-based taxes, tariffs, excises, excise taxes, import duties on imports. And that's what they did. And basically, they said, listen, a tax on land, a direct tax on land, is the most pernicious type of tax, and the federal government wouldn't have the authority to do that. So they drew distinctions between what was kind of commonplace at the local level and what the new federal government would do, and they viewed it as a positive that the federal government wouldn't have that power. So this is something that's just been part of Western society, even predating the United States of America. It's an easy way for local governments to get a stream of revenue. And in Florida, what's happened is because the property values have skyrocketed, particularly anytime a house is sold, the new owner, they're at a much higher tax basis. And so what the local governments will say is, oh, well, we didn't raise the millage rate. Yeah, it's true, you didn't, but you've assessed the property at much higher levels. And so that same millage rate is going to produce more tax liability. And here's the thing, Jenna, you know, you buy a house, you know, say you buy it for $400,000, and then 2 years later, someone's telling you it's $800,000 and you got to pay tax on that different amount. But until you do a transaction, nobody knows how much your house is actually worth. The market goes up and down. When the market goes down, they don't reassess your property lower. It's basically a one-way ratchet. And so this is a great time to really think deeply about, okay, what are the most effective ways to raise revenue? Now, look, Florida, we have millions of more people than New York State, and our budget is less than half of theirs. So we have the lowest number of government employees per capita at the state level of any state in the union. We have the lowest per capita debt of any state in the union. So we're doing it right. But you do need to raise some revenue for state and local. The property tax is really the main driver for local. Florida, at the state level, utilizes the consumption tax, the sales tax, which is also something that's interesting because people that live here, like you know, if you go to the supermarket and you buy food, most of what you buy in the supermarket is not subject to sales tax in Florida. I mean, there's no tax on what they call unprepared food. So, and then a lot of the essentials and the consumer staples that you need are not subject to sales tax. So what is you going to get more bang for the buck for Florida residents, a property tax cut or 0.75 cents on a sales tax? Clearly, if you're a homeowner in Florida, you're going to do better on property tax relief.
And this is benefiting residents, as you said, not just the tourists who come into the state, and that's better for the residents and for Florida. And yet some in the state legislature are suggesting that this amounts to a government handout. One Florida member said and posted this on social media yesterday, the last career politician offering free checks in exchange for political support was Joe Biden. Government handouts isn't conservatism. I disagree with that because, tell me how much of my money is the government's to decide to give back to me. That's kind of an idiotic position.
So
but what's your response?
It is absolutely bizarre. I mean, this is you're paying property taxes, and the way it works in Florida, this is very complicated. But there is a portion of your local property taxes that is effectively mandated by the state, and it's called the required local effort for education. And so, what we're proposing to do is we have a massive surplus. We can fund the required local effort with our general revenue as a way to give these folks a $1,000 tax cut. And so it is a tax cut. We're relieving them of a tax obligation that the state has imposed historically. So to equate that with Joe Biden handing out stimulus checks, a lot of times to people that don't even pay taxes, it's just bizarre. But I'll tell you, it raises a larger issue. I mean, I think people have looked to Florida as the leader on all these different issues for 6 years. And they're like, this is the model for Republican states and everything. And for whatever reason, the Florida House of Representatives in this iteration, they are not living up to that reputation. In fact, they're hearing a bill today, not on reducing property taxes, but on carbon sequestration. This is a total scam. They pump the carbon in the ground or even in the ocean floor. A lot of people make money. It's a boondoggle. It grew out of Biden's Green New Deal, which Congress should repeal. And it's a Democrat who's running this bill. So how are we in a situation with this massive Republican supermajority that we're devolving into doing things like carbon sequestration? Last week or 2 weeks ago, they came in, Republican members of the Florida House joined with Democrats to undo spending cuts that I instituted last June. Every single Democrat voted with them to add pork into the budget in this fiscal year, which we only have about 3 months left on that. How is that conservative? That is not what these guys campaigned on. And so I think we're seeing, and I'm going to say something more about this later, but they actually are so petty that they are fighting to take away an office in the state capitol from our U.S. Senator Ashley Moody. Senator Rubio had this office for 15 years. I appointed Senator Moody when Marco became Secretary of State. They kicked her out. The House of Representatives tried to kick her out of the office because she opposed the House's amnesty legislation. I called for strong immigration legislation. House rejected that. They tried to do an amnesty that ended all governor-led immigration efforts in Florida and gave exclusive authority to the Commissioner of Agriculture. It was a total debacle and a total farce. And ultimately, the blowback was so severe that they had to come to the table and do a strong bill. And now we're leading the country in this. But because she spoke out against that, they're now taking away this, and they're trying to create legislation to where they're able to regulate parking spaces and office spaces in the Capitol. I'm just thinking to myself, how embarrassing is this for Republicans? How embarrassing is this for the state of Florida that this is what it has devolved into? They're focusing on climate ideology. They're focusing on office space and parking spaces. And there's a whole lot of other stuff, you know, under the hood. And we're going to be very vocal about what they're doing. Here's the thing, Jenna, you don't have to agree with me. You run, you get elected. If you just simply follow the platform you ran on, if that's my platform, great. If it's not, then you know what? You told the voters what you're going to do, you do it. But what these guys are doing, they ran under the banner of the Florida model and the Florida success. They all asked for my endorsement. They put pictures of me and them in their literature. And they've attained power using the goodwill that voters have to our successes. And they're trying to weaponize that power against the interests of the people that sent them there. And that is unacceptable. And so we're not going to let it happen. We're not giving an inch. We have defeated the Democratic Party and the left in Florida more than any other state has. My job is to keep them there, not let them come back. I'm not throwing them a lifeline.
And it sounds like we've lost the governor, and so we'll try to get him back really quickly. But, you know, this is something that I have heard from a lot of my fellow Floridians, both in person as well as on social media, just really frustrated about exactly what the governor is talking about. And it reminds me of the same thing of some of these Republicans who asked for Donald Trump's endorsement on the federal level, and they ran under the MAGA banner, and they ran under, you know, liberty and freedom and Trump's agenda, and then they get to Congress and they vote either against that or they make it so hard for Speaker Johnson to actually lead a conference. And in Florida, we have a supermajority. It shouldn't even be that difficult. It's not like we only have a majority by, you know, three or four seats. This is not something that should be difficult. It should be something that, as the governor said, you know, you don't have to agree with him on every issue, just like members of Congress don't have to agree with Trump on every single issue. But as conservatives, we all should at least have an ideological framework that is similar, because that's what they ran on. And so for we the people, residents of Florida, or if you are outside of Florida in your state, just like the state of Texas is really dealing with this very same issue, and they primaried a lot of their candidates, and they got rid of a lot of these rhinos because they were so sick and tired of seeing that in their own legislature. And so that's a great thing that I think we need to do here in Florida. But we also need to be very prepared coming up in the midterms on the federal level as well, to not just look at the endorsements, not just look at the campaign platform, because anybody can speak a good game, they can talk a good talk. We need to look at the person, we need to look at their track record, and then we need to absolutely hold them accountable. So I'm being told that there's a service issue. We can't get the governor to call back in, but I really appreciate his time. So we'll go now to break. And I'm so grateful to Governor DeSantis and his team for their time this morning. And whenever he has an opportunity, we'll certainly get him back on to finish all that. I love how much history he knows. And just, you know, you can ask him anything, and I have, about American history, all that. He just knows his stuff. That is what I love and respect so much about him. We need leaders like that in every single position in office. So we are going to come right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning and talk about judicial activism and how we can actually stop what my friend Mike Donnelly calls juristocracy, right after this.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, Marine Le Pen was barred from French presidential run after an embezzlement ruling. This coming from the New York Times yesterday. The sentence made the far-right leader, you can tell where the New York Times is coming from with that, but the sentence made the far-right leader ineligible for 5 years, excluding her from the 2027 election unless she can secure a more favorable outcome on appeal. So the sentence also required her to spend 2 years in home detention, few years on probation, some massive fines. Those things were not imposed immediately, only the ban on being eligible to run for public office. So then The Hill writes that President Trump weighed in on the French leader being barred from seeking office for 5 years after being convicted of embezzlement, telling reporters that it is, quote, a very big deal and that it sounds like this country. That is a big deal. That's a very big deal, Trump said. I know all about it. And a lot of people thought she wasn't going to be convicted of anything. I don't know if it means conviction, but she was banned for running for 5 years and she was the leading candidate. So a lot of people are talking about that this morning, and other more right-leaning world leaders even weighed in supporting her. And this seems to be a topic of judges who are weighing in on elections and having a collateral consequence of conviction, seeking to bar them from office. And my response to this was, this scenario in France is exactly why conservatives were saying, in the midst of the lawfare of President Trump over the last 4 years, this is exactly why our Constitution does not prohibit a candidate from running for office based on a conviction, because those can absolutely be manipulated. And this is what we mean by judicial tyranny. So let's welcome in Mike Donnelly, who is an attorney and professor. And Mike, I had you on this morning anyway, even before the news of Le Pen broke, because we wanted to talk about this whole idea of judicial tyranny. Congressman Andy Biggs has a potential resolution that I want to get to in a minute. But overall, when we're talking about juristocracy, as you call it, and how judges can weigh in on election issues like this and basically infringe and disenfranchise the vote, infringe on the right to access the franchise. This is how we get to judges in robes determining elections. And good morning.
Hey, good morning, Jenna. Great to be with you as always. And your listeners, good morning, everyone. Yeah, this term juristocracy, it's a global phenomenon, as you know, you see. And I haven't really been following the Marine Le Pen situation, so I don't know if the embezzlement charge is legitimate or not. It wouldn't surprise me if it wasn't. But, you know, no one's above the law, and we certainly don't want people embezzling funds that they're entrusted with. But for judges to be making the call on who gets to run for office and who doesn't is antithetical to the idea of democracy. You look to Brazil or other countries. I mean, look, if you've been convicted of a crime and the voters want you, I mean, that's up to the voters. You know, we have the government that we elect. And if we want to elect a bad government, which we've had for a while, then we get to do that. That's what democracy is. And this idea that judges are going to save us from ourselves or they're going to interpose their judgment in place of ours is the problem with juristocracy. You know, Mark Levin wrote a great book about this, Men in Black, and the idea that, you know, judges have become increasingly political, exercising political judgment. And that's what we see going on right now, which is why you have people like Andy Biggs and others seeking to impeach some of the federal judges who are enjoining President Trump's actions, or as Congressman Biggs is suggesting, using the good behavior clause in Article 3 to try to impose some discipline on the judiciary branch.
Yeah, and let's talk about that because, breaking just yesterday, there was yet another federal judge, and this was breaking from Fox News, federal judge Edward Chen in San Francisco has blocked the Trump administration from ending TPS or temporary protected status for 350,000 Venezuelans in the U.S. for now. Their work permits and protection from removal was set to be terminated next week. Stephen Miller, a Trump advisor, quote, posted this and said, "This is what we mean by judicial tyranny. Biden mass imported illegals from Venezuela, including criminals, gave them welfare and social security numbers. President Trump won an election promising to end the invasion. A rogue Marxist judge just ordered Biden's amnesty continued." So clearly we have a problem, and I think this isn't just an American problem with what we're seeing in France, what we've seen elsewhere in other countries, even just in the last few years, with this type of judicial tyranny. So Andy Biggs' suggestion, because impeachment requires the two-thirds majority in the Senate, even if you get to the articles of impeachment for conviction and removal. So his suggestion is using the good behavior clause to pass a simple resolution. Explain his theory on this and whether you think this is potentially viable.
Well, Article 3, Section 1 says the judges, both of the supreme and inferior courts, shall hold their offices, quote, during good behavior. That's what the Constitution says. The congressman is looking for solutions in the right place. He's looking for solutions in the text of the Constitution. The problem is that is not how, unfortunately, the founders thought about it or how it has ever been done. Now, I'm a very creative person, or at least I like to think I am, and I love creative thinking. So I really give Congressman Biggs a lot of credit for coming up with this idea and saying, hey, look, we appoint judges through the Senate with advising consent on a majority rule. Why can't we remove them on a majority rule? I think there's some merit to at least exploring it, but under the founding, that's not how it's ever been done. There have been 15 impeachments over the last couple hundred years. We've impeached federal court judges. The last one, I think, maybe 1989 or maybe more recently than that. And the founders debated this, actually, during the Constitutional Convention in 1787, when they put the phrase good behavior in. It was a proposal by one of the delegates, and they were going to put in language that would have basically explicitly said, if the executive asks and the legislature by majority vote agrees, a judge can be removed. But they voted that proposal down. Now, that's how it was done in England right before the revolution. You know, there were two ways to remove judges in England, which, by the way, judges in England did have life terms, unless they were removed under two ways. One was the one I just described. The other was if the judiciary itself removed them for bad behavior under a writ of what's called sire facias. And we don't have that. We've never used that in the United States. And so when you think about what the founders were thinking about, they wanted an independent judiciary that was impartial, okay? And that's why they put in this idea of good behavior, letting judges be independent. And we want that because that was something that they didn't have during the colonial times because the judges were dependent on the king. It was different from in England where they had life terms, but in the colonies, they didn't. And so that was a problem because they depended on the king. They did the king's bidding. And we had enough of that. And that's why we said, we're done with this. No king but King Jesus. And we're out of here. But now we've kind of come full circle. We have judges like Boasberg and Chen and others who are acting politically. They're not being impartial. So what do we do? So I really appreciate what Biggs is doing here. We've got to have a conversation about this. The way it's been done in the past is we've run articles of impeachment. We've impeached a number of judges. The Senate has convicted judges in the past. But there is another way that this can be done. Congress has set up the Judicial Council, 28 U.S.C. 332, or Judicial Conference, rather. And Congress has set this up and said, look, judges, you got to police yourselves. And so there is a mechanism where people, and anyone can do this, can complain to a circuit that a judge is violating the law or violating their judicial ethics. And I think when you look at the judicial ethics that these federal judges are supposed to adhere to, impartiality is one of them. And I think a lot of these judges have compromises. Judge Boasberg in particular, I think, you know, has problems. So that's one thing. But one problem with Judge Boasberg, who people may realize, is the one who was the one who tried to get the planes to turn around when we were sending those violent criminals to El Salvador, who's got family members who are in the immigration business. The problem is he's the chief judge of the circuit. And so you apply to him, and he's the one who gets to make the initial determination. So there are some problems with disciplining the judges under the law. And as you pointed out before, Jenna, it's hard to get an impeachment, and it's really hard to get a conviction in the Senate. But I really want to give Congressman Biggs some credit for thinking outside the box here.
Yeah, and I think this is really frustrating to a lot of people because we're seeing how obviously politically biased and politically motivated these activist judges are. And there doesn't seem to be a remedy because they are appointed for lifetime tenure. So it's not, well, primary them or vote them out or, you know, we the people have any sort of say. And so this type of tyranny can persist when, of course, the Democrats who are benefiting from the outcomes that they prefer are not going to vote on impeachment papers or an impeachment accusation based on the law and impartiality. Of course, they're going to prefer the political outcomes. So does all of this really go back to ensuring that we have people in Congress and the Senate who are willing to look at the political nature of judges? Because if we had, for example, a 2/3 majority of conservatives in the Senate, true conservatives, not these rhinos and, you know, the spineless people, then we may get an impeachment and a removal of a judge as a valid potential threat to their position that would either keep them in check or they would go off and do all their political opinions and we could actually hold them accountable. Where is the first step to actually remedying this type of judicial tyranny?
I think you put your finger on it, Jenna. It really does matter who we have in Washington, D.C. when it comes to this federal judiciary, because the Congress is the one who has authority to control the judiciary. You know, the Constitution only requires one Supreme Court. In 1802, the Judiciary Act under Thomas Jefferson, they completely got rid of all the circuit courts. And Jefferson thought all of the judges were being partisan. They were all Federalists, and he was an anti-Federalist, basically, the Democratic-Republican Party, and they were all against him. And he said, you know what? His party was, you know, in the majority, and they were able to, through majority, get rid of all the circuit courts, which got rid of all the judges, and they were able to rebuild the judiciary. This was upheld by the Supreme Court in 1803. So Congress has the authority to do lots of things. So it really matters. I guess I just want to point out one little thing. Our judges do not have lifetime tenure. The Constitution does not give them lifetime tenure. It says good behavior. What does that mean? Well, that's what we're arguing about. And how do we get rid of them? Well, that's what we're discussing. But we are fighting for the life of this republic. We didn't get here overnight. It's been 125 or 150 years of building upon building upon building as the federal judiciary has built this power. And we've talked about this over the past about, substantive due process and incorporation of the Bill of Rights and all kinds of things about how the judiciary has accumulated all this power where it somehow can just, with a wave of its pen, Justice Kennedy decides, let's get rid of 31 state-level constitutional amendments, which he did in Obergefell, and we somehow think this is okay, that a federal judge can get rid of 31 state constitutional amendments defining marriage as a man and a woman that the people of the states voted for and say, hey, look, that's what we want in our state, but five federal judges can say, no, that's not how we're going to do it. That's the problem we're dealing with when we talk about judicial tyranny and a juristocracy, and it's not going to get solved in 100 days under the Trump administration, but I give Stephen Miller and President Trump credit for taking on these difficult challenges. But as you see, as everyone listening sees, these judges think they can stop the president. 77 million people voted for President Trump. Not a single person voted for any one of these judges. It's insane. It's absolutely unacceptable that one district court judge thinks it can stop the president from deporting people under the law to protect our safety and security, and we have to do something about it.
Yeah, and specifying that a lot of these courts, and in fact all of them under Article 3, other than the one Supreme Court, which is required under Article 3, I mean, all of these circuits and districts are a creation of the Judiciary Act. One of the remedies that Speaker Mike Johnson has been proposing is to simply defund some of these positions, mm-hmm. and to use the power of Congress and the Judiciary Act to basically just eliminate the position and not allow these types of forum selecting. Do you see that potentially being a remedy? And obviously, I mean, we run into the practical problem of can you get the votes in order to pass this? But that aside, let's just, talk about, the issue itself. If we could get to the votes, is that potentially a solution?
Absolutely. Like I said, Congress has broad authority. I mean, it can completely eradicate all the circuit courts. It can certainly defund certain positions or certain courts. It can completely change the nature of the court system if it wants to. It has essentially plenary authority. Now, you got to get the votes. And so I think, we the people need to decide, do we want to continue to live under this juristocracy or do we want to change it? There are people who are trying to do work in this area. A number of people that I know, Tom Fitton at Judicial Watch and others who are doing really good work. This is something we have to work on as a country, and it's not going to get solved overnight. But what Speaker Johnson is talking about, what Andy Biggs is talking about, I'm so glad that we have leaders like them who are voicing the problem, putting it in front of the people, and are proposing legislative solutions to deal with it.
Well, well said. And I think this is a conversation that needs to continue to progress. And Mike Donnelly, really appreciate your insights this morning. And it really does come down to whether we the people are going to require our Congress to use their authority under Article 1 and even what Article 3 requires of federal judges and not allow this type of judicial tyranny. Because a lot of what I'm seeing on social media, even from people like Stephen Miller, who I think is, a brilliant lawyer, is complaining about it. And that's fine. But as, one of my mentors, who actually wrote the foreword to my book, by the way, always told me, don't complain about a problem unless you can provide a practicable solution. And so I think we've all complained about it enough. We need to pursue solutions so that we don't continue to live in this type of juristocracy. So Mike Donnelly, thanks so much. We'll be right back with more. Will you take a moment and celebrate life with me? Last year, Preborn helped to rescue over 67,000 babies from abortion. Hi, this is Jenna Ellis, and I want to thank you for your partnership. Think about what you did. 67,000 babies are taking their first breath now because of you. Your $28 sponsored one ultrasound that was given to a woman as she was deciding about the future of her child. Once she saw her precious baby for the first time and heard their sweet heartbeat, her baby's chance at life doubled. But Preborn's mission is not only to rescue babies' lives, but also to lead women to Christ. Last year, Preborn Network clinics saw 8,900 women receive salvation. Your help is crucial to continue their life-saving work. Your caring, tax-deductible donation saves lives, so please be generous. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR, or dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Your love can save a life.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. So as President Trump is dismantling the Department of Education and school choice bills are on the rise all over the country, the woke radical left is realizing that they are losing their monopoly on government-funded indoctrination camps. And so states like Illinois are attempting to crack down on homeschooling. And basically under the guise of increasing state oversight of homeschooling, really it is a big brother to parents. So HB 2827 from the Illinois General Assembly has passed in the Education Policy Committee last week, March 19th, and it would require proof of immunization and a health examination or an exemption for only regularly occurring public school sponsored public school activities. But it also requires a homeschool administrator to have a high school diploma or its recognized equivalent at minimum. A lot of this is a problem, or a solution rather, in search of a problem, because studies show that the outcome of homeschool students in terms of their actual education, the ability for parents to direct their education to tailor the learning needs around the student, the outcomes are so much better. And from a personal standpoint, I am one of those statistics, because I was homeschooled K through 12. My parents chose that option, and I'm grateful not only that they chose that option, but that they had the right to exercise that option here in the United States, and to care about not just my schooling, but about discipleship. So anyone in Illinois that cares about parental rights and cares about children's education really needs to stand up and oppose HB 2827. And let's welcome in Will Estrada, who is senior counsel for the Homeschool Legal Defense Association. Will, thanks so much for the work that you and HSLDA are doing on this bill. Give us a little more information as to what this bill contains and why it is so damaging to parental rights, but also just simply to students to have the opportunity for their parents to choose this option.
Well, Jenna, thank you so much for having me on. I guess we got two homeschool graduates talking on air today.
Woohoo! Look at that.
So HB 2827 would undo 75 years of home education freedom in Illinois. Back in 1950, there was the landmark Illinois Supreme Court decision, People versus Levison, which established that home education was legal in Illinois as a type of private school. And when you and I were being homeschooled in the 80s and 90s, when HSLDA was fighting across the 50 states, where, you know, many states it was illegal for parents to homeschool their kids in the 70s, 80s, and early 90s, Illinois was actually a bastion of freedom. Families from neighboring states would move to Illinois, and it's worked very well. Homeschoolers have to teach the regular subjects. People versus Levison established that the burden of proof was on the homeschool family to show that they had evidence of education. And along came Representative Tara Costa Howard, a state representative in Illinois, and the bill is premised on two false premises. First, that homeschoolers are more at risk of abuse and neglect, and actually that's furthest from the truth. Studies, peer-reviewed studies, have shown that homeschooling is very safe for children. Homeschoolers are at less risk of abuse and neglect, but also that there are no regulations in Illinois, and that's just false. You have to educate your children. In addition to what you said as you were leading up to this, HB 2827 would do something not one state does. It says if you don't file the annual homeschool declaration form, then you are automatically subject to the criminal truancy penalties, which is a Class C misdemeanor. It's a criminal conviction, up to 30 days in jail, $500 fine, criminal conviction on the record. And then, as you know, when a parent goes to jail, DCFS, the state Child Protective Services gets involved. We could even see children removed from homes and placed in temporary foster care, all for simply not filing a piece of paperwork. So Illinois would go from actually the one of the most free states for homeschool freedom to the worst state because of this criminal penalty if you don't file it. Not one state in the nation does that.
That seems to be just beyond absurd and beyond some of these other ridiculous requirements. That seems to be intended just to provoke those types of consequences and is a mechanism for compulsory reporting of parents to have to notify the state we're homeschooling and therefore draw more attention to them. And who knows what the other peripheral consequences may be, whether, you know, there could be pretextual, you know, kind of welfare checks. I mean, some of this stuff that if you notify the state and basically flag yourself, then that could give rise to some of these other factors. So Will Estrada, who's a senior counsel at HSLDA, if Illinois has this great track record, I mean, why is this bill coming up in session right now?
That is a great question, Jenna, and this is all being fomented by an outside organization. It's an organization called the Coalition for Responsible Home Education. They were founded back in 2013. They're a Massachusetts-based think tank, and basically they are a pro-authoritarian, anti-parental rights organization dedicated to rolling back homeschool freedom. They have on their webpage a document called Parental Rights Extremism Messaging Guide, and they go on and on about parental rights extremists. And in their mind, almost anyone who homeschools their child is a parental rights extremist. They were behind a bill which would eliminate one of two ways that families homeschool in Virginia, the religious exemption option. Thankfully, that bill failed earlier this year. It was introduced in January, failed in February on a bipartisan vote. But we're sort of seeing a pendulum swinging across the country where in certain states, opponents of homeschool freedom, those who believe in authoritarianism, that we need the government to protect children, they are trying to roll back these hard-fought freedoms for parents to be able to choose how their children are educated. They failed in Virginia. They're trying here in Illinois. And our concern is they're going to be coming soon to a state near you.
And if they fail in Illinois, it seems like they may go to, as you said, to some of these other states, which, you know, is what it's the same thing. It reminds me of the same thing that happened here in my home state of Florida with you know, some of these outside organizations who basically want to buy a ballot measure or buy legislation. And they're seeking to utilize government to push through their own outside agenda instead of the legislators actually thinking that this is a good idea and consistent with regulation. So do you expect this to pass? And if so, Will, what is your view? I mean, I'm sure HSLDA will litigate on this. What will be the likely outcome in the courts when we have so much great precedent on the parents' right to direct their child's education?
That is a great question, Jenna. So first of all, our goal is to defeat this in the Illinois legislature. It's passed the first step, the House Education Committee, but numerous Democrats spoke out against the bill. In Illinois, there's kind of a weird system. You don't get to testify. Only a few people get to testify in person, but you fill out witness slips. And with less than 24 hours notice, because the bill was amended right before the hearing, homeschoolers in Illinois, 51,000 filled out witness slips, and only about 400 people, and many of them were out-of-state people with Coalition for Responsible Home Education, filled out witness slips in support of the bill. So that really got the attention of legislators. 51,000 to 400 is pretty stark. There's a long process. It's been stalled on the House floor because even a lot of progressive Democrats have said, wait a minute, criminal penalties? I thought we're trying to reduce people in the criminal justice system. So that's created a lot of angst. The homeschool community has come out against it. We still have the fight in the Senate if it were to pass the House. So I think we got at least a 50-50 chance of beating this in the Illinois legislature. But you are absolutely correct. If this bill were to pass, HSLDA and many of our allies would aggressively litigate it. It would be difficult, but the criminal penalties, I think, are a bridge too far for a lot of judges. I think we'd have to wait, though. I don't know if we'd win a facial challenge, so I think we'd have to wait to see how the how the law, if it were to become law, were to be applied in a criminal system. But have, you know, make no mistake, this would be very chilling to the home education community, to minority families who may not have the money to hire an attorney. So the best outcome would be that the Illinois legislators say, wait a minute, this is a solution in search of a problem. Let's reject this bill.
Yeah, and I know that we at the American Family Association have put out a lot of opposition to this this bill, and we've been very vocal as well with HSLDA and other organizations who recognize that this is a solution in search of a problem and would be very damaging to homeschool parents overall and to the students. And so how can anyone who's listening from the state of Illinois, how can they help HSLDA attempt to defeat this bill?
Well, first off, thank you so much to AFA and what you're doing, Jenna. Your general counsel, Abraham Hamilton, is one of our board members here at HSLDA.
We love him.
So there's a close relationship there. If you are listening in and you're from Illinois, visit hslda.org/HB2827. Of course, on our social media, both on X and Instagram and Facebook, which is just simply HSLDA, we've been putting out a lot of information. There's going to be a pretty high-profile press conference in downtown Chicago on Thursday morning. We'll be streaming all of that on our social media channels. I'll be there. And then even if you're not in Illinois, encourage our listeners to check out the work we're doing at HSLDA. We truly do believe, and it's an issue of grave concern, that there's going to be this concerted attempt in other states to try and roll back homeschool freedom, private school freedom. One of the things HB 2827 does is it also targets traditional brick-and-mortar private schools. So we need to prepare, because parental rights, you know, we're coming up on the 100th anniversary of Pierce versus Society of Sisters on June 1st. It's too precious to surrender our hard-fought freedoms.
Amen to that. And you can also follow Will Estrada on X at @Will_Estrada and also follow at HSLDA. And, you know, as we talked about off the top, you know, as President Trump is dismantling the Department of Education, you know, reducing all of that on the federal level, and then so many states are passing school choice options that benefit homeschooling, benefit even, you know, private religious institutions and give parents more options for choice. Is that part of this whole pushback and our teachers' unions involved? I mean, not just the organizations that you've talked about, but is there kind of a broader movement to maybe try to claw back some of this power that now is being dismantled because, you know, we're kind of on to what's going on with publicly funded institutions?
You know, that's a great question, and there really is a philosophical battle, and it's a battle between worldviews, and it essentially comes down to who is going to make decisions for children. Will it be the government using force of law and threat of arrest, or will it be parents and grandparents and family and people who know a child? And it's a clash between worldviews. And so on one hand, I'm very pleased to see the rolling back of Department of Education. You know, I remember back in 2010 when the Department of Education was being used to bludgeon states and schools into changing their curriculum and how kids are taught with the Common Core state standards. And so anything that kind of puts the decisions closer to the parents and the local control is good. But then in some states like Illinois and New York and California and others, it's not going to make much of a difference for homeschooling. And so those are still going to be state-by-state battles of engaged moms, dads, grandparents, family members, local community coming together to protect and preserve homeschool freedom and parental rights.
Yeah. And Will Estrada, in just the last minute or so that we have as well, what should people be looking for outside of Illinois so that it's not just, you know, so far down the pike when they see, you know, some of this legislation that may crop up in their own states? Are there, you know, action alerts and some of these things from HSLDA that they can just be aware of some of this at its inception?
Absolutely. We say three things. The first one is, get engaged. Know who your local representatives are. You can visit them now if they're friendly, if they're hostile. Just go down to your state rep, state senator, introduce yourself, bring some cookies, say, I'm a homeschool family. Thank you for what you do to keep homeschool freedom. So build those relationships. Second, join an association, either Homeschool Legal Defense or a local or state homeschool organization, so you can be prepared and equipped and we can be ready if bills come. And third, love your kids. continue to do what you're doing, whether it's homeschooling or private school, or, you know, not everyone can, and I know some of our listeners, their kids are in public school. So build those relationships with your kids and your community to be prepared for when the threats come.
Well said. Well, thank you so much for the work that you do to advocate on behalf of parents and children, Will Estrada. So great to talk with you. And we need to be praying that this bill will fail. And as always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.